Hello, Katie. I'm Dominic. This is the Europeans podcast. No, I'll try again.
How long have we been doing this?
Too long, apparently.
That was a lovely introduction. I think it's possibly because it's so early. Again, you need to stop singing, Dominic. These early recordings that we're having to do to fit around your busy singing schedule, they're killing me. Haven't even finished my breakfast.
Yeah, I have what we call in the business another three-session day today, which is morning, afternoon, and evening. And I really shouldn't complain because most of my colleagues around the world have zero employment and I just happen to be living in a country where they don't really care about shutting theatres and concert halls for the sake of COVID.
Yay!
Which is a very mixed blessing right now, but I am happy, obviously, to be in employment.
Something else that we've got to be happy about is that the jingle you just heard, our friend Jim, what wrote it, he just beat Robbie Williams to a prize at the Stage Debut Awards. Not for writing this jingle, I should add, although it is a very good jingle. It's for an amazing Christmas musical that they wrote. It's called The Season, and it's going to be a smash hit. And yeah, we just wanted to wish our heartfelt congratulations to Jim.
That's seriously good news and impressive, but also kind of sad for us because it means he's going to be too big to help us with our jingles.
We don't need him now. He's just done a new jingle for us. So thanks, Jim. It was nice knowing you.
How's your week been, Katie?
Good. I've been reporting in the French countryside near Bordeaux this week, which was very lovely. And it sounds quite glamorous until I tell you that I was reporting from a urine treatment plant.
Oh, yuck. Did it really smell?
It didn't smell of anything. It smelled nice, actually. It was nice and very well ventilated. But I've realised that because of the lockdown, I've only reported from two places physically this year. One of them was a giant rubbish dump and the other one was a urine treatment plant.
You have a really glamorous job.
But it was really interesting. I was learning about how amazing our wee is. It's full of nutrients. Did you know that?
I did know that because, yeah, in Amsterdam, we can, if you're stuck in the street and need a wee, you can wee into this like special plant urinal thing.
And it feeds the plants.
Yeah, and our wee feeds the plants.
Amazing. Wee is amazing. Moving on, what's coming up this week?
This week, we're going to be speaking to Eniola Aluko, who is the British-Nigerian football star, commentator, ex-entertainment lawyer and all-round superstar. We wanted to speak to her because she's had an incredibly successful football career. She made 102 appearances for the England team and is now the new director of women's football at Aston Villa. She's also regularly seen commentating on women's and men's football on British TV. And did you know she was actually the first female pundit commentating on the BBC's flagship football show Match of the Day?
No, I didn't know that. Amazing.
We'll be talking to Eni about racism in football, sexism in football, and a lot more. Her really interesting upbringing in Birmingham. And Katie and I will be pretending we know something about football.
We know all about football. Time for the continent's favourite segment, Good Week, Bad Week. Who has had a good week, Dominic?
It's been a good week for Alexei Navalny, one of the Kremlin's fiercest critics, who had been poisoned, almost certainly with the nerve agent Novichok, in late August. And this week was able to walk out of hospital in Berlin 32 days after he'd been flown in for emergency treatment. He is staying in Germany for the time being as his rehabilitation is ongoing and he will be in and out of the hospital for treatment for at least another month. The doctors don't know yet to what extent he will have long-term complications from the poisoning, but Navalny said in an Instagram post that he was working hard to get his motor skills back to normal, including hopefully full use of his left hand.
Jesus.
Yeah. Intense, but it could have been a lot worse by the sounds of things.
So is he going to go back to Russia once he feels fit enough to do that?
Yes. His allies say that he wants to get back to Moscow as soon as he can, which is pretty wild considering the Kremlin possibly, probably just tried to kill him. Do you want to hear the official line from the Kremlin?
Shoot.
According to the Russian press agency TASS, the Kremlin said that it was pleased that Navalny was recovering well and that he would be, quote, free to return to Russia like any other citizen.
Oh, that's got like really strong sort of mafia vibes. Like, yeah. Come on back, you'd be very welcome. It's sort of more sinister because they're sounding friendly.
Indeed, and you might want to take more note of the actions of the Russian authorities than their words. Not only is the Kremlin strongly suspected of being behind the poisoning of Navalny, but actually, whilst he was lying in a coma in the hospital in Berlin, the Russian authorities sent the bailiffs to Navalny's flat in Moscow and froze his assets in connection to a legal battle with a catering magnate who just so happens to be a close ally of Vladimir Putin himself, known as Putin's chef. It's a sign that life is not going to get any easier for Mr. Navalny once he is back in Russia. And the international exposure he gained due to his poisoning is not necessarily protection from further attacks from the Kremlin. The Kremlin has been pretty shameless in recent decades in their suppression of critics.
We're kind of catching up on this. It's the first time we're talking about this poisoning. Why would the Kremlin have wanted Navalny out of the picture?
Well, I should repeat that the Kremlin deny that they had any involvement in the poisoning, of course, but it happened in the run-up to local elections in Russia where the opposition were expected to do better than they usually do. The elections took place a few weeks ago now, whilst Navalny was still in intensive care, and the opposition did do pretty well in some Russian cities, causing the pro-Kremlin party, United Russia, to lose its majority on a few city councils, including in Novosibirsk, the third largest city in Russia. A city I actually went to when I was 10 and saw a Russian stripper.
Yes, you've told this story before. Have we got time to get into it again?
No, I think we should leave it at that. Yeah, I just accidentally ended up in a strip restaurant.
As you do.
Navalny's allies won a handful of seats in a few cities. It's not like they won much actual legislative power. And the fact that a few wins of council seats is considered success for Navalny and the opposition in Russia tells you something about how hard it is to fight against Putin and his team. Economic hardship has made voters somewhat more skeptical of the Russian government in recent times, but Putin still has an approval rating sitting at around 65%, a rating that many other European leaders would be very happy with, I'm sure. And whilst he might be in a bit of a diplomatic tussle with Germany and other Western nations following the poisoning of Navalny, it doesn't seem like the international criticism is going to bother him too much, sadly.
Water off a duck's back.
That said, it's amazing that Navalny seems to be recovering so quickly following what could very well have been a fatal poisoning. I think it's incredibly brave that he's preparing to go back to work in Russia, trying to expose the ruling power as what his team describe as a party of crooks and thieves. So good week goes to Alexei Navalny.
I was looking at his Instagram earlier and he sounded like he was in quite good spirits, actually. It was quite funny, although obviously it's extremely dark what he's just been through. But he said he looked at himself in the mirror and it looked like some sort of creature from Lord of the Rings was looking back at him.
I have that sometimes.
Oh, me too. Not from Novichok poisoning. He actually specified that he looked like a Lord of the Rings creature, but not one of those like handsome elves, Orlando Bloom type figures. And he was also campaigning for the medical team to give him a PlayStation for his rehabilitation so that he can, quote unquote, get his brain working again.
Glad to see he's campaigning for the important things right now. He deserves a PlayStation. I also read this morning that Der Spiegel are reporting that he had a secret visit from Angela Merkel when he was in hospital.
I'd like a secret visit from Angela Merkel.
Well, if you get poisoned by Novichok and end up in Germany, then who knows?
Not quite worth it.
Where are we going for bad week?
Well, last week's show came out just as the EU was releasing its much anticipated plan on how we're going to solve the endless arguing over how we welcome asylum seekers to this continent. Welcome is probably a strong word. I don't think the approach has been very welcoming. But yeah, I wanted to bring you up to date on that. It is a complicated one, and I'm not here to tell you that this policy is like 100% bad news. Basically, what's happened is, back in 2015, when more than 1 million people turned up in Europe claiming asylum, a lot of them from Syria and Afghanistan, the EU, as you probably know, came up with this plan to share out the migrants country by country under a quota system. And as we know, some countries flatly refused to do that. Hungary, Poland and the Czech Republic. And the whole thing fell apart. So the new system tries to get over that sort of roadblock. And under the new system, each country would have a choice between either taking in refugees that arrive here and resettling them, or taking part in operations to send people back if they've had their asylum claims rejected. What do you think about that?
Well, why would they choose to take them in if it's not politically advantageous for them? Like, is anyone actually going to do that?
I mean, this is one of the big problems with it. And certainly in Germany, which has probably done more than any other country in Europe to take people in, there's quite a lot of German politicians who are now saying, is this just going to result in us having to take everyone in? Like, what if all of the other governments just say, sure, we'll help send people home, and that's all we're willing to do? So yes, that is a big possible problem with it.
There is a fund, isn't there, for the countries that do decide to take in refugees?
Right. I mean, looking at sort of previous experience, like over the last couple of years, we've seen this ad hoc system turning up where when boats arrive, countries have been sort of ad hoc volunteering to take in shares each. So I guess some of those countries that have tended to do that might end up taking migrants in. But yeah, we don't really have a proper plan yet. There's not many details. This policy plan was rushed forward, of course, because of the massive fire at the Moria refugee camp in Greece, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And I'm going to give this bad week, because I'm going to say it's still a bad week, despite this announcement, for all of the refugees, thousands of people who are stuck in camps on the Greek islands. Because at best, we're looking at a possible deal on this in December, and these discussions are not going to offer any kind of immediate solution for the more than 12,000 people who were made homeless by the fire at Moria. The Greek authorities are building new temporary shelters, and the EU is pushing for people to get transferred off the island to the mainland. But the conditions in these camps are still horrible, frankly, and will continue to be horrible for the foreseeable future.
How have aid groups who help refugees been responding to this new report?
Yeah, not great. They're not the biggest fans of this new migration plan. One of the main things they're worried about is that this system is still going to end up with people getting stuck in horrible detention centres while officials try and work out if they've got a valid claim for asylum or not. So there's still going to be these massive bottlenecks in the system. And Amnesty International has called it a rebrand of a system that was already failing. I mean, I guess if we're going to be charitable, we should say let's wait for more details. But in the meantime, I think we need to keep pushing for proper solutions and humane living situations for the people who are already here and stuck in these horrible situations.
Yeah, and I guess it is a difficult nut to crack to like be able to come up with a plan that will please Hungary and Poland and the Czech Republic and also get something done.
Yeah, I think with my practical, boring, pragmatic hat on, the old system just wasn't working, and it is good at least that we're trying something a little bit different. Ylva Johansson, the Home Affairs Chief for the European Commission, she had quite a good way of putting it. She said that it's a deal that no one's happy about, which in a way sounds kind of like weirdly democratic, and also something that generally signifies that we have some sort of compromise going on in Europe.
Isn't that just what every European plan ever has?
Exactly.
And it's partly the problem with Europe, that it's a deal that no one hates, but no one loves.
I mean, this is a deal that no one loves, definitely, and most people hate, but it's something to work with. The latest kind person to support this podcast is one of my neighbours. Isn't that so nice?
That's so sweet.
It's my friend Michelle Serafinelli. Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you, Michelle. And thank you also, Daniel Farrell, for upping his monthly donation today. We saw that.
Yes.
Very kind. You can join Daniel, Michelle and the other lovely patrons on patreon.com/Europeans podcast by giving as little as 2 smackers a month. I don't know which currency to use, because now you can actually pay in euros, can't you?
I think people have reported problems with switching currency. We are going to fix that. But yes, in theory, you can pay in pounds and euros.
Very exciting. We're moving into the 21st century.
We know that these are really tough times for a lot of people, and we are super grateful to those of you who are reaching into your pockets for us. But there are other lovely ways of supporting us. We got a really nice email this week from Emily in Portland, Oregon, in which she described herself as a self-proclaimed Europeans pod ambassador / evangelist. It sounds like she's got half of Oregon listening to us. So be like Emily. Tell your friends to listen. And your enemies. Do you know what? I am not a sporty person, but I think probably the most I've got into sports in the last few years was the Women's World Cup last year, which was hosted in Paris. And I went to watch the final in a bar with our mutual friend Ingeborg, who was cheering along the Netherlands. Did you watch?
No, I didn't. I don't watch any football. I'm sorry. It's terrible of me. But I'm kind of inspired to watch more football after speaking to Annie. And maybe you will be too, because she kind of paints a picture of the football world maybe not being quite as racist and sexist as I thought it was. Maybe
is that the main reason why you don't watch football? Or is it just because you're not sports inclined?
There is that. But that, I think a reason why I'm not so football inclined specifically is because it feels like a kind of semi-homophobic world. Like there are very few out gay footballer players internationally. There are a few. But it's always felt like a pretty unfriendly place for a gay man growing up. So I do think that's a reason why I never really got into it. But anyway, enough about me. Annie speaks much more eloquently about football.
Annie was a star striker on the England team. She also played for Juventus in Italy before retiring from the sport in January and taking up a job as sporting director for the Aston Villa women's team. And we had a really great chat about a lot of different things, actually. Racism in football, her experiences playing in Europe, and hunting for the next female star of European football. Here is Annie Aluko. You've described how when you were training like early in your career, you were discouraged from playing football in like a showy kind of way. Do you feel like that's still the case in women's football, that players get told off for being individual in a way that doesn't happen in men's football?
Yeah, I think certainly there is, you know, a social expectation, I think, for women and girls to be, it's a more egalitarian approach. You know, everybody kind of has to fall in line and be the same. And whereas I think in boys football, individuality is probably a bit more encouraged. And I think that's the same in life. You know, if a woman doesn't sort of prescribe to certain ideals of being a woman, she's seen as a, you know, rebel or, you know, a bit different. And that certainly was the case growing up in football. As a girl that was skillful, was fast, had a bit of personality on the pitch, I didn't always feel like that was necessarily encouraged. But that level of flair when I grew up was then expected to just come out of me, even though it was kind of discouraged when I was younger. So I think that's just part of football culture in England that's now changed, now that football's become a lot more global and a lot more sort of has a lot more European influence. A lot of coaches are taking ideas from Spain and Holland and Italy, which then means that players are encouraged to do more sort of continental things, I suppose. So it has changed a lot, but certainly growing up, I did feel a little bit scared to express my individuality.
I read in your book that as a child, you were pushed for a while in the direction of tennis by some of the adults around you who thought it was maybe a more appropriate sport for girls. Why do you think tennis is seen as more appropriate?
Tennis has had a head start in terms of women being accepted and equality for women and the integration of women into what is seen as sort of professional tennis. It's had a head start. So growing up, me seeing the Williams sisters, you know, celebrated, playing, winning, getting paid, you know, it felt like women's tennis was much more accepted than football was. We've still got a little ways to go for women's football, but I think tennis, you know, with people like pioneers like Billie Jean King, they did it much earlier than, you know, some of the people in women's football have been able to do.
Well, you certainly proved some of those dads on the sideline who in your early age were like grumpy that a girl was allowed to play with the boys. But I was wondering, you also had a law career as well as your football career. You went through law training and you were an entertainment lawyer. Obviously, men who are as successful as you in football don't have to have a parallel career to make ends meet. Did this ever irritate you?
It wasn't something that irritated me. I think it was actually something that I found was an opportunity to just be more multidimensional and have more opportunities when I finish playing. You know, I come from a family of educated people who, regardless of football, encourage education. And actually, my brother, who's a professional footballer, he always actually said to me, you know, you've got a brighter future than perhaps me, because post 15, 20 year career, yes, I probably have a lot more money in the bank than you. But actually, in terms of having this established career post football, everything you do during football really sets you up for that. So having a law degree, working at law firms, doing a master's, it allowed me to for the transition into sort of quote unquote working life to be easier for me as a professional footballer. Whereas a lot of the guys, as rich as they are, they have a lot of issues transitioning into other working life if they choose to work, or finding some purpose in something else that they're doing, because ultimately they're not really prepared and set up for that. So I'm actually quite grateful in the way it's worked out.
Yeah, I can imagine. You were famously dropped from the England squad after describing your experiences as a black woman in the squad in what was an apparently confidential interview.
Yeah.
That was back in 2016. Do you feel like things have moved on since then, or are we still wrestling with exactly the same problems?
That's a really difficult one to answer because, you know, I've not been in the England setup since 2016. So without being part of the team, you know, I wouldn't want to sort of make any assumptions. What I would say, though, is that as part of sort of the process, which was a very, very adversarial and difficult process for me at the time, post that, I was able to work with the FA to at least inform them about, you know, one, some of the things that can be better moving forward so it never happens again. And, you know, whistleblowing policies were discussed, complaints procedures were discussed, and they were very open to me being part of that. Whether that's something that's been implemented, I really don't know. But what I would say is that the team right now, I think if you look at it, it doesn't look as diverse as it could be. When I was playing, there was four or five representatives in the team, you know, of, you know, black and ethnic minorities. Now I don't think there's any. Now somebody would say, well, you know, you pick the best players. But also equally, is that saying that there's not enough good black players playing in England? I'm not sure that's an argument that you can hold. So I think there's an issue there, just from an aesthetic point of view, just like, where's all the representation? But equally, we have that problem full stop.
I know you've also played for Juventus in Italy. Italian football is also not known as being necessarily the most welcome place, I think, for black footballers. And I was kind of curious about your experience there. Was it different at all from playing in England?
Yeah, I mean, my experience in Italy was a positive one. You know, I won everything there was to win out there. I finished top scorer in my first year. You know, I was able to learn Italian. I was able to travel Italy. So yeah, I mean, it was a great experience and something that I really valued. But yeah, of course, you know, I experienced racism, I experienced prejudice, as I have done in England. It felt more intense because I was away from home and I couldn't speak the language. But, you know, I don't want to sort of paint my whole experience in Juventus to be a negative one. I don't want to suggest that I left because of racism, because I didn't. I left because I had a big opportunity to return to England and start a new career. You know, I didn't enjoy some of the things that happened, like, you know, going into a store and being profiled. And a few times I landed at the airport, I felt that I was being targeted. That was never enjoyable. But that's a few negative experiences in an 18-month period that was very positive.
Did you ever grapple with the idea that football unfortunately has like some uncomfortable relationship with nationalism and xenophobia? And when you were playing for the England team, did you ever feel uncomfortable playing under this flag, St George's flag, which is a thing of pride for a lot of English people and also is sometimes used as a symbol to represent racist values?
I'm very blessed to have played for England and played 102 times. You know, it's something that I'm very, very proud of. You know, I was never racially abused ever when I played for England. I see myself as British as much as anyone else who's raised in England. But I'm also, you know, quite clearly Nigerian. So does the flag represent some xenophobia? Probably for some people, you know, but that's a minority. And I think the minority make it that, you know, the hooligans that go abroad and cause trouble. But speaking from personal experience, you know, I never felt a level of xenophobia or racism towards me as an England player representing my country. I think because of Brexit, because we're living in a world that is very them and us, those things have intensified and those voices have become louder because they can. Because when you have leaders of the world like Donald Trump openly being xenophobic and racist, of course, you know, there will be fractions of every country that try and sort of make the flag seem exclusive to a certain group of people. But that definitely wasn't my experience. And I look back on my England career with pride, really.
You are the host of a new TV show called Ultimate Goal, which is searching for the next European superstar of female football.
Yes.
She's somewhere in Europe. Where have you been looking for this person and what are you looking for?
Yeah, so Ultimate Goal is a great show, something I was really pleased to be part of, because effectively it's about giving players a second chance to really show their worth and their skill and their ability where they may not have been had the opportunity to play on a good pitch with good resources in a professional environment. We had players from, you know, lots of European teams, player from Malta, we had a player from Holland. I'm really excited for it to come out. I'm really excited for everyone to see it. There's lots of funny parts, there's a lot of emotional parts as well. The backstories of a lot of these girls, it's not been an easy life for them. So I hope people will be inspired and I hope the show can continue for the next few years as well.
This interview was the final interview in our series of interviews organised around the Forum on European Culture, which took place last week in Amsterdam and online. Annie spoke at an event called Football, the People's Game. So if you want to hear more from her, I really recommend checking out the video of the event, which will be sitting in our show notes. She also has a book that I listened to. It's called They Don't Teach This. And not only is she a great footballer, but it turns out she writes in a really interesting way and has a really interesting life story to tell. Did you know her father became a Nigerian senator during her childhood? And she talks really beautifully about the slightly bewildering experience of going to Nigeria as a teenager when her father was being sworn in.
You also said that she's got a really nice voice for audiobooks, didn't you?
She does. She's got a really good calming voice. I listened to it whilst painting windows in my flat and it made the painting about 100 times more enjoyable than it would have been.
What have you been enjoying this week apart from Annie's book?
I've just finished a binge through this series called Hannah, which is on Amazon Prime. It's a kind of thrillery spy thing where like some secret teenage genetically modified girls are working for the CIA and running around beautiful areas like the primeval forest in Poland, bits of Romania, England, Germany, Spain, everywhere, all over Europe. It's based on Joe Wright's film, Hannah, and people who've watched that film, which I haven't, say that this series did not need to be made. Yeah. But I love Mireille Enos, who's one of the CIA agents in it. I think she gives an amazing performance, as she did in the US adaptation of The Killer. But there is this, like in the second season, there was a moment where I was like, why am I watching this? Because they go on the London Underground and they say something about, he's in a second class carriage towards the front of it. You need to step in. And if anyone who's ever been in the London Underground will know that there is no first or second class carriage. And that made me think that it was written by people who had no idea what they were writing about.
Does any municipal underground train system have first and class second carriages? I'd be intrigued to know.
Good question. Probably somewhere they do.
Maybe it's a good idea. Get rid of the hoi polloi.
What have you been enjoying?
I've got a long read for you this week. Enough television. I've been watching loads and I decided I was getting a bit square-eyed. So I've been trying to read words. And something that I really enjoyed this week was this absolutely mad piece in The New Republic called The Vampire Ship, about this huge drug deal in Greece that went terribly wrong. And then people connected with the case started dying in mysterious circumstances. Greek listeners will know the case I'm talking about. Apparently the newspapers in Greece were absolutely obsessed with the story for a couple of years. But it's just wild. And I'm really sorry to sound naive, but I didn't realise how nasty criminal kingpins can be. It gets really dark.
Maybe you haven't been watching enough TV then.
Maybe not. It's been really well told, this story here by Alexander Clapp, a journalist in Athens. And it's a really meaty long read. I think it takes you about half an hour to read. So if you've got a long train journey coming up, this is one for you, I think.
If you do have a long train read and you get through that article and you still have time, then I also want to recommend the latest edition of Are We Europe's magazine. It's a climate issue and I've been enjoying it a lot, despite the slightly gloomy topic.
Oh, and you should get their newsletter as well, which has been pleasing me greatly every week when it lands in my inbox. It's just a nice sort of tour of all the interesting things that have been happening around the continent this week, much like this podcast. But again, words.
I have a genuinely happy ending for you this week for once. Researchers in Iceland have published a paper providing evidence for the first time that suggests that seabirds are able to use tools.
Oh, are they picking up little hammers?
When I say tools, it might sound more amazing than it actually is. A tool is defined as like an implement with some kind of function. And in this case, the tool is a stick and they're using their beak to pick up the stick, and the function is scratching a part of one's own body. And when I say one's own, I mean a puffin's own. So puffins apparently use sticks to scratch themselves. Isn't that lovely?
Oh, that's such a nice image. And also scratching an itch. So satisfying. Good for you, puffins.
There was already evidence that non-seabirds could do this, but this research from the University of Oxford and the South Iceland Nature Research Centre is the first evidence of seabirds using tools for the aforementioned itching and scratching reasons. Up until this research was published, many scientists had just assumed that the brains of the seabirds were too darn small to be able to think about using a stick to help reach a hard to reach scratch. So the fact that they can do this, I think, is really nice news. And there's even a little video which I'll share with you, but I have to admit, when I watched it, I was actually a little bit skeptical. The bird clearly picked up this stick with its beak, but the scratching was a little bit underwhelming. It almost looked like accidental scratching, I'll be honest. But these poor puffins on the island of Grimsey in Iceland have had a tough time of it recently. There's been a nasty tick infestation over the past few years, and the researchers are speculating that perhaps the pointy stick is actually helping them remove ticks and not just scratching an itch. Anyway, clever puffins, whether you're doing it for tick purposes or scratching purposes, I approve. That's all we have time for this week. I gotta go and sing. Casey's probably gotta go and write about urine.
Yay!
Will we get to read about that sometime?
You will. Hopefully next week. I'll post the link in the show notes, along with the 90,000 other links that we seem to be posting these days.
Isolation inspiration is partly to blame for that. But I think people are sadly going to be becoming a bit more isolated again in some parts of the world. Oof. Don't mention the war.
I hope everyone's doing okay, wherever you are, and that this podcast isn't making things worse. We will be back next week, but if that's too long, there's always our back catalogue to listen to, and also our delightful posts on social media. Where can they find us, Dominic?
They can find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod, Instagram, EuropeansPodcast, Facebook, The Europeans Podcast, or send us an email, hello@EuropeansPod.com.
Podcast.com.
Did I not say that?
Nope.
How am I going to eat sing today in different languages if I can't even say an email address? hello@EuropeansPodcast.com.
Well done. Good luck singing, Dominic. We'll see you all next week.
Bye.
Adios.